listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. We're going to focus on two things. First, the APEC summit, that's the Asia-Pacific Economic Conference, that took place over the 16th to the 18th of November in Papua New Guinea. China's President Xi Jinping highlighted a challenge of choices between cooperation or confrontation. There was no final declaration because of a disagreement between the U.S., Japan, and China over a draft. And President Trump didn't attend this year, rather sending Vice President Pence. We're also going to discuss Argentina, which has some serious economic issues. But let's start with that APEC summit. And President Xi and the region and China, which is something that I end up talking with just about everyone about, because China is pretty much everywhere these days.
Yeah, and the APEC summit, it's that, what is it, the Asia-Pacific Economic Summit.
Yeah.
The almost all the important Asian countries, plus the United States, some countries from Latin America, and among the Latin America, in fact, there were only three Latin American countries, Mexico, Chile, and Peru, all of whom are members of the so-called Pacific Alliance that's a block of right-wing governments, countries with right-wing governments that are trying to promote a kind of neoliberal free trade agenda and an integration model based on that kind of thinking in Latin America. So three of those countries were participating in the APEC summit. And I think this does point to what we've been talking about many, many times in previous conversations, that the the contradiction between the United States agenda in Latin America and elsewhere, in this case Asia, and the agenda of the countries in the region concerned, in this case Latin America, are not necessarily aligned. Because, for example, President Trump didn't attend that summit. He sent his vice president, Mike Pence,
right,
which some people interpreted as an insult to President Xi,
right,
and the other presidents.
Yeah, some of the racist media here, of course. Well, you know, that means that he lost face. You know how them Asians are. You know, it was kind of some of the spin they put on it here.
Yeah, but on the other hand, the Russian Federation wasn't represented by
either, right,
Vladimir Putin. It was represented by Medvedev, the
right,
prime minister.
Right.
So, you know, I think that, as you say, that's just a kind of way of the Western media getting in a dig at President Xi.
Right.
But and the main speech at that APEC summit was President Xi's speech, and it was very positive, very open, talking about the need to promote cooperation rather than confrontation. And so whereas in terms of what it was saying to the Asian countries and the Latin American countries, they will have taken that in the spirit in which it was meant. The United States may well have looked at that and taken that as a threat, because I read at least one commentator, one Western commentator, not sure if it was Reuters or one of them, saying that President Xi basically said in his speech that we can either take the road of cooperation or confrontation almost as a challenge to the United States. But he's not the one making the challenge. The people that are the government that's promoting the kind of conflict, if you like, is the United States government, because
right,
it's as the position of the United States has weakened vis-a-vis global rivals like China and the Russian Federation, instead of pushing for ways to reach an accommodation that serves everybody's interests, what President Trump has done is push for protectionism and tariffs, and
right,
he started this trade war with China, but it's not clear how that's going to pan out. But the probability is that it's not going to pan out in anybody's favor, but least of all for the United States. And it remains to be seen, of course. And it might even work. Who knows? I'm not an economist.
Right.
I don't know. But it seems to me that the APEC summit was a forum in which all those very important countries, South Korea, Thailand, I think Indonesia was present, really, really important economies in the Asian region, and also
right,
at a global level in the case of Korea and Japan,
right,
but also these Latin American countries, Mexico, Chile, and Peru, and they were there observing this. They have to make up their minds which way they're going to jump, because
right,
the United States puts it in those terms. China doesn't.
Right.
China just wants to cooperate.
Right.
And so, what's likely to, what does that mean for Latin America? In Mexico, you have Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's going to take over the Mexican presidency, I think, on December the 1st. And Jair Bolsonaro, the Brazilian president, he'll be taking over the Brazilian presidency,
right,
also in month of December. Of course, Brazil wasn't at that summit, but
right,
I'd be very surprised if they weren't observing it very closely. And it'll be interesting to see how Jair Bolsonaro's extreme right-wing discourse, the kind of macho bullying bluster that he's come out with prior to taking the presidency.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see how that gets modified when he has to deal with global realities. Now, the person that he's chosen for his foreign minister is somebody that's really obscure and who doesn't seem... It's a very strange choice that seems to be based on the individual's religious beliefs more than his diplomatic skill or experience, because he's not a front-rank Brazilian diplomat. So we may be in for some surprises in terms of Brazil's foreign policy. But going back to Mexico, Chile, and Peru, we've already talked about how Peru is working closely with Bolivia to develop the Chinese initiative of transcontinental railway. Will that go ahead as a result of the change of government in Brazil? We don't know. But and the fact is that Peru is very much on board the idea of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative in so far as it impacts on Latin America, because it'll, for Peru, that'll mean that it opens up trade across to the Atlantic, and which will be very important for the Peruvian economy. Likewise in Chile, and although Sebastián Piñera is also a very right-wing politician and a close diplomatic ally of the United States, the Chilean business and commercial elites are very much in tune with China's approach to commercial affairs, economics in general, and the Chilean economy is very interested in maintaining successful trade relations with China, and Mexico too. Mexico is likely to increasingly develop its trade with China, but it's faced with this contradiction that the recently renegotiated NAFTA agreement. I've forgotten what they call it now. They've changed the name, but essentially it's the same,
right,
with a few tweets that Trump has window dressed as, you know, a great breakthrough for the United States and a complete renegotiation of the NAFTA treaty, which of course is nonsense. And there may be some benefits to the renegotiation that he's achieved, but I'd be very surprised if it makes any fundamental difference to Mexico's natural economic development towards China, because China is a much more dynamic trade partner than the United States. And Mexico is unlikely to develop its economy by closer integration with the United States and Canada. It's much more likely to develop its economy by developing across the Pacific towards China and the other major Asian economies. So, and, you know, and that's that. In summary, looking at the APEC summit, and I do think it's fair to say that Mexico, Chile, and Peru are likely to continue to drift away from, in terms of trade policy, away from the U.S. sphere of influence and the U.S. United States way of doing things, and to integrate more and more over the next 3, 4, 5 years into the sphere of influence of China's trade vision, which is, you know, China has a trade vision that is win-win for everybody. That's their slogan, isn't it? Like, we want win-win trade relations with all our partners. That's what the Chinese say.
Yeah.
Whereas the United States says, do what we want or else. You know, that sounds very simplistic, but when you boil it all down, that's what relations with the United States come down to: do what we want or else. And the relationship with China is, well, let's see how we can work out something so that we both do well out of it. You know, so yeah. If you were the governments of Mexico, Chile, and Peru, regardless of your political complexion, who are you going to work with?
Right.
You're going to work with people. You know, it's just obvious, isn't it? And that to me is the significance of the APEC summit, because President Xi confirmed that approach on the part of China and made very clear that it's not, for its part, it's not going to deepen the current conflictive trade atmosphere that's been provoked by the policies of President Donald Trump.
You have a few moving parts in there. First of all, the recently announced, soon to be foreign minister of Brazil. He's got almost an ideological, or has expressed almost an ideological antipathy towards China. The communism was the big Megillah, and then it was nihilism that's the big scary thing, but nihilism in service to China's international interests, and so he warns people to beware of that. But at a press conference in the last few days, he said, well, actually, we're going to be looking around at the best deal we can get from Brazil on everything and showing no favoritism towards anyone. So we'll see how that is. What it does tell me is that, as you're mentioning, the China's role, in these different places, they were an alternative. If the only deal, and I have nickel and I have uranium and I have whatever, the only game in town is either it sits in the ground or we sell it to the United States and EU, they're going to dictate the terms. I got somebody else that's coming in here and they offer me something else. Oh, well, we'll build a road or we'll do this or we'll do that. Now you're in a game. And you can negotiate and work this against that. You have some leverage, and so just the existence of China in that landscape is a benefit. And it seems that he's giving at least new foreign minister in Brazil is giving at least lip service to that idea. We'll see how that actually plays out. And I think just in general, if you take a look at the landscape. I mean, we saw this with Chavez before, and the whole way that the region started to engage the world and the nations, each other. We don't care what your ideological system is, your political system, we'll do business with you. China does it that way now, it may be that even the right wing, as these governments come to power, because we've seen Macri also, reaching towards China and doing some business with China. I think that there's a constituency among the elite down there to play both ends against the middle, or at least willing to entertain it and to provide an appearance of doing that. And that's an interesting change in dynamics from Monroe Doctrine politics.
Yeah, and even in Brazil, and when just after Jair Bolsonaro, we discussed this a little, and I think we both agree that what we have to see, apart from how Bolsonaro's policies play out geopolitically, internationally, when he comes bang up against the international realities. The other thing is, as you just pointed out, how he's going to cope with the inter-elite squabbles and conflicts over policy, in particular over trade policy. Commercial policy, because, as you say, and there are big chunks of the Brazilian elite that would do very well out of trading with China.
Right.
And one of the things that's interesting there is that, and I don't think I'm misremembering when I say that I think Embraer, the big Brazilian aerospace company, they had a joint venture project with China, I think, developing, I'm not sure if it was advanced airline stuff or aerospace stuff, but that if it hasn't already been knocked on the head by the current usurper government under Michel Temer that's in its last days now, it's likely to be under Bolsonaro, because why? Because U.S. interests like Boeing and Lockheed Martin and those big U.S. aerospace companies really didn't like to see the emergence of Embraer as a global competitor, which it was beginning to, it was right. Starting to become. So that's just, I only mention that as an example of the kind of inter-elite fight that's going to be going on, especially in the first year or so of Bolsonaro's presidency,
right.
As they try and reach some kind of accommodation about who gets which chunk of the pie.
And the
other thing that's interesting about that is Bolsonaro is taking over at a time when it was interesting that you mentioned Argentina in relation to that, because Macri, as you said, Mauricio Macri, went to China and I think they negotiated various deals while he was there.
Yeah.
But the, what he actually did there doesn't really matter. The point is what you said, that the mere fact that he's going there indicates that Argentina is another Latin American country that, even though it's not on the Pacific side of the continent, simply cannot afford to ignore the reality of Chinese in China's increasing global commercial leadership.
Right.
Because the United States isn't offering leadership. The United States is like a crab retiring within its shell. And it's China that's offering global commercial leadership.
Right.
And so, and another reason, of course, in Argentina's case, why it was so important, is because their economy is crashing through the floor.
Right.
That's also very important as we watch Bolsonaro take over Brazil, and who's leading his economic team. And I don't know if he was actually one of Pinochet's Chicago boys, but he's of that, you know, that's where he's coming from ideologically. So Brazil is going to go through unless something very strange happens between now and, you know, over the next year, Brazil's likely to experience over the next year the kind of economic shock that Chile did and that Argentina is now experiencing. Right. If you look at Argentina's economy, I think I sent you some notes on this before we started talking. Its industry is currently only operating at 60% capacity.
Yeah.
Auto manufacturing in Argentina is quite an important industry. Textiles are quite an important industry. They're both operating at below 50% capacity. Inflation right now is at 45%. It's likely to end the year at 50%, the highest since 1991.
Yep.
So there's a collapse in consumer demand because people can't afford the prices. There's no sign of any productive turnaround in the economy, and I don't think anybody knows the real current unemployment figure in Argentina, but it's likely to be well over 10%, probably more like 20%.
Right.
And among youth, it's likely to be well over 20% right now.
Yeah.
So, and what you have in Argentina is exactly what you and I predicted back in 2015, immediately after the election. The economy has gone through the floor. The economy is now more in debt than it was at the time of
right.
the crisis back in 2000, which saw the collapse of the government back then. And this is what Brazilian people voted for.
Yeah, well, you know, Paulo Guedes is the one you're talking about.
It's obvious that that's what's going to happen to people in Brazil.
Right.
It's obvious that now that the what Mauricio Macri offered during his election campaign back in 2015 was just completely false, just a downright lie.
Yep.
And in Argentina, something that's worth pointing out that's been very much in the news over the last few days, and something that really symbolizes the falsity and the hollowness and the moral vacuity of right-wing governments in Latin America, and in particular the Macri government in Argentina, is that they finally discovered the sunken submarine, the submarine that went missing over a year ago. It's the boat was called the San Juan. And it was lost at sea over a year ago, and the government really treated the relatives of the 44 dead mariners shamefully.
Right.
And there's absolute outrage among, and you know, and these people are military families. you know, they're not
right.
They're not the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo. They're not right. kind of radicals or progressives or, you know, and these are military families, and they're absolutely disgusted with their government. And that, you know, that radiates out from them
yep.
to their social and economic class, and the people who like them, who almost all of them will have voted for Macri. Right. And they can now see, in the same way that the United States government treats its veterans disgracefully, and they can now see that the right-wing government in Argentina is treating their military disgracefully.
Yeah.
And that's just completely symbolic of the right-wing government of Mauricio Macri in Argentina. And if you try and kind of conceptualize that at a regional level, look at what that means. It means that Argentina, one of the wealthiest countries in Latin America, one of the most important economies in Latin America, has crashed through the floor. Its population have been ground down into impoverishment by right-wing policies. And if you compare that with Venezuela, Venezuela has survived very severe sanctions, and it's going through serious economic difficulties. But those economic difficulties are externally applied. Yeah. They're externally generated.
Yes, warfare.
The United States and the European Union
that
have forced sanctions on economic sanctions on Venezuela's population, and then hypocritically they turn around and say, oh, well, look at all these refugees from Venezuela. Isn't that terrible? Right. As if they have no role in that. But there in Argentina, their own government, with the total complicity of the United States elites and the IMF and the European Union's approach to dealing with international relations and dealing with social policy. And Argentina is an extreme example of what has been happening in Europe in terms of austerity. Just as a footnote to what we're talking about, Philip Alston, a special rapporteur for the United Nations, just produced a report really condemning outright the austerity policies of the United Kingdom government because of what it's done to generate something like 13 million people in poverty in the United Kingdom. So yeah. And there's total hypocrisy from the part of the Western governments, Western institutions, Western media, in their coverage of their own countries, but also in particular in their coverage of Latin America.
Let me just say this much here. You can see that this is on the agenda for Brazil now. You know, Paulo Guedes, who is the person that Bolsonaro has, you know, nominated to be the economic minister, his PhD, University of Chicago, taught by Milton Friedman. They're going to do exactly the same thing in Brazil that Macri has done in Argentina, that all of those people did across the EU, particularly, you know, in the places that are being hardest hit by austerity. That their solution to the problem of austerity is more austerity.
Argentina has elections in 2019.
Yeah.
Now, it remains to be seen whether Cristina Kirchner will manage to stay out of jail, you know.
Right, to be allowed to run. Are they going to do to her what they did to Lula? They're trying.
Yeah, they're trying to do to her what they did to Lula. But and the interesting thing there is that both the more social democrat progressive politicians there and Cristina both agree that they can't afford to mess about on petty ideological differences. The important thing is to defeat fascism, which is something that Dilma Rousseff has also been saying this week at an important forum, political forum in Buenos Aires. But let's see what happens. On the basis of what happens, Argentina is heading for a very serious crisis, and it's not clear at all whether it will be able to be resolved politically or what's going to happen. And likewise, Brazil. We'll just have to wait and see how things pan out.
Yep. So we got about 2 minutes. What else do you want to touch?
In terms of the 2019, I'm talking about that election in Argentina. We also have elections in various countries there, which are, let's have a look. The most important elections are the ones in Argentina. Bolivia has presidential and legislative elections, which Evo Morales is likely to win, and he's almost certainly going to be allowed to run as a candidate. And then in other countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, Panama, and Uruguay, and all those elections will be important, but are unlikely to change the overall balance of power. The most important one is going to be the election in Argentina. And the other important thing to see will be whether Andrés Manuel López Obrador can make an impact on the regional situation vis-a-vis the dominance of the United States.
Right, exactly. In other words, in Mexico, where they did have the election, where the progressive won, you know, the progressive won, quote unquote, in Ecuador also with Lenin Moreno, and that took a sharp turn away from where people thought. Let's see what AMRO does, too. I've got to keep an eye on that. All right, well, thank you for your time, as always. Maybe we could take a closer look at some of those elections next week and some of the other things that are going on in Cuba, the progress on the Constitution, Venezuela's municipal elections coming up next month, and a bunch of other things that are happening. And appreciate your time, Tony, and be well.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tony.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. As the rift between the U.S. and the rest of the world is growing wider, at home, Democrats are now in control of the House. How big of a game changer is the result of the U.S. midterms for the rest of the globe? I ask two-decade CIA veteran Rolf Mowat Larsen.
As the U.S. midterm elections leave the country in political stalemate, with Congress divided between Republicans and Democrats, the White House continues to pursue its divisive foreign policy line, which is making America's European allies uneasy. Can the president hope to achieve his global goals with the Democrats in the House? Will the alliances and treaties put in place by his predecessors endure the Trump treatment? And how will the U.S. move forward in tomorrow's world?
Two-decade CIA veteran Rolf Mowat Larsen, welcome to the program. It's always great to have you with us. It's been a year. Things have changed. Lots to discuss. Now, world leaders recently gathered in Paris to mark the centenary anniversary of the end of World War I. In his speech at the ceremony, French President Emmanuel Macron delivered fierce criticism of Trump's nationalism and the America Comes First approach. Is this the beginning of a real rift between Europe and the U.S., this escalating rhetoric?
I don't think, Sophie, that it's the beginning of a rift. I think that would overstate the problem. I do think that our transatlantic relations have been damaged by President Trump's criticism of NATO, demands that he's making of NATO, and frankly, taking the alliance for granted. And so to that extent, I think President Macron and, for that matter, Chancellor Merkel were making a statement that that if the U.S. decides to push this in this direction, they have options as well.
Well, it's not just NATO. It's Iran deal. It's the tariff wars. Trump pretends not to care about what the Europeans say. But nevertheless, he replied with a whole series of tweets in response to Macron. So does that mean that the Europeans got under his skin, that he actually cares more about the relationship with the EU than he wants people to believe?
I'm not sure I can draw any conclusions from this I would call divisive activity. I think the strategy, if you want to call it that, as you referred to, pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, about potentially pulling out of the intermediate nuclear forces agreement, and in terms of challenging NATO's future, I think those are very divisive and destructive for the United States. And I hope the president sees the wisdom of pulling back and reinforcing our ties to our old allies. And the behavior we're seeing from the other side, whether it's the Europeans or other countries in the world, is a reflection of their determination not to give in to U.S. pressure.
So right before Armistice Day celebrations, Macron cited both Russia, the traditional boogeyman, and the United States as threats to Europe. How likely are we to see a Europe that is more active militarily and less willing to rely on Washington in terms of security?
I think we're a long way from seeing NATO in any way being less relevant, or the Europeans building a European army, or any of these other grand statements. But I do think it's significant that Europeans are taking this opportunity to re-examine their own security and their independence from the U.S. and other parties. I don't think that's unhealthy. I think the reality is that the world is a very different world than the Cold War that created NATO and created these security arrangements. And all the agreements, the arms control agreements, the nuclear agreements, and other things should be re-examined. I think we're a long way, though, from speeches turning into practical realities, but the discussion's healthy. Although, as I just said, Sophie, I disagree completely with President Trump's strategy in this regard.
So how could Trump's rosy relations with some of the Eastern European countries, like Poland, play into this?
Well, clearly, every country is making new decisions as to where its interests lie. That includes Russia, of course, and other countries that are deciding for themselves what course they want to take. Again, I don't think this is necessarily threatening, and I hesitate to overstate the danger called by this national populism. It's a dangerous trend, I agree, but again, people need to be able to speak out other concerns. Part of what we're seeing is an airing of citizens' grievances with their own governments. And I think that has to play itself out, as it did in the UK with Brexit, as it's doing in certain East European countries. And we need to be very respectful of the process. As we like to say in the U.S., because we have our own share of dysfunctionality right now, there is a sort of elegance to the checks and balances of people sparring with their leaders, the ruled and the rulers. And I think we need to respect the process.
So do you think the Europeans actually need to start building up their own security system independent of NATO?
I think the idea is intriguing. Again, I'm a philosopher by nature, so when the Cold War ended, I thought there was a grand opportunity for the U.S., Russia, and Europe to potentially craft a new security architecture that would serve everyone's interests. I think if we had done that at that time, rather than enlarge NATO, rather than, of course, Russia invading Ukraine, or Georgia, or these other actions that have occurred over the last 20 years, I think we would all have greater security. And that would have included a way to take into account everyone's security interests and devising, in a way, a new framework for how we think of the world. So maybe that process is 20 years late and it's starting now. But I think that's healthy. Again, we're a long way from any fundamental changes, whether it's in NATO or in other security arrangements. But I do think the discussion is healthy.
If Europe does become more self-sufficient and start to pay more for its own defense, as per Trump's wishes, will this be a boom to the U.S. economy? I mean, you said it would be a disaster to U.S. economy, but maybe it will actually be able to cut some more defense spending, put it somewhere more useful. And also, what happens to the defense contracts currently serving European security interests?
If I said that European defense taking a greater role in their own defense would be disastrous to the U.S. economy, I certainly didn't mean that. I think, and I didn't use the word disaster because I think, again, that's an overstatement. I think we should base our thinking on existing frameworks, which provide some stability and order to the world. So whether you're looking at nuclear agreements or NATO or other security arrangements, I think the basis for thinking how we change things should be leaving the things we have intact. So if in the context of a strong NATO, Europe feels it's in its interest to become more independent, spend more money on defense, of course that's a good idea. Where I completely disagree with President Trump's approach is the thinking that we have to destroy existing agreements.
No, but the question is, what would it do to American economy? What would it do to American economy? Would it improve it?
I think our economy is changing. I think what we used to... Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not an economist. I do know that what Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, used to call the industrial military complex is a very different thing today than it was when he discussed it or we thought of it in the Cold War. And I like to think our economy is very resilient, and maybe we'll create new opportunities as a result of the shifting security landscape. But I don't think fundamental relationships are going to change. For example, I don't think that President Trump's frankly divisive statements towards the Europeans is going to lead the Europeans in a different direction. I think ultimately they see the U.S. as a strong ally, and it will outlast Donald Trump.
Will it? Because a Europe that is less reliant on Washington in terms of security is also arguably a Europe that is less willing to play down its wishes on policy. In your opinion, is this a concern for Washington? Could a more independent Europe, for instance, be more independent on the Russian question, for instance?
Well, maybe Europe should be more independent on the Russian question. We've spent 20 years working on a model which has got us to a state where we've got a war in Europe right now, essentially, in Ukraine, and we've had other problems as a result of sticking too much to the, I'd call the dogma of the Cold War. So I think we have to be careful how we talk about and plan changes, but I think having a Europe that's more inclusive of Russia and the United States, for that matter, that takes in account Russian security interests is healthy for all parties. And I certainly would be against that process. But let's not start by breaking the order as it exists today. Let's use that as a basis for changes. If I can, Sophie, use one example. The INF agreement, the U.S. has announced that it may be pulling out of the agreement on intermediate nuclear range forces. Why are we doing that? Why not stay in the treaty and make adjustments that take into account the realities of how the world's changed in the 30 years since the agreement was reached in 1987? Today we have drones. Today we have ballistic missile defense. Today we have new technologies that both concern both the United States and Russia legitimacy. So let's negotiate a new framework. Let's include China and internationalize the INF agreement. Let's not just cling to the past. Let's take the past as the basis for creating a better future.
And we're now in the wake of the U.S. midterms, which saw Democrats take over the House of Representatives. To what degree can that affect U.S.-European relations, especially on the issues of trade war? And now military financing as well.
Well, we now have a situation in the United States where the parties are split between, of course, the Democrats took charge of the House of Representatives and the Republicans control the Senate. I think what that means in practical terms is we're going to be in a stalemate for 2 years. As a citizen, I'm not a political pundit or expert, but I don't think the Democrats are in much mood to negotiate with the Republicans or President Trump. So I think people are going to have to acknowledge that the United States over the next couple years is going to be consumed even more so by our internal bickering and affairs. I hope I'm wrong, but that's what I see. So all parties should make their own plans in the sense of taking into account the issues that are critical to them over the next couple years. But I think they should rest assured that our process will ultimately result in some sanity being restored to our system. At least that's what I hope as a citizen.
All right, Rolf, we're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to two-decade CIA veteran Rolf Mowat-Larsen, talking about the U.S. midterms and what they mean for the U.S. and the rest of the world. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with two-decade CIA veteran Rolf Mowat-Larsen discussing the implications of the U.S. midterm elections for the American politics. So, Rolf, can't Trump's intentions to improve ties with Russia, which he was vocal about at the beginning of his presidency, be buried for good now with Russia hawkish Democrats running the Congress?
I think it's going to be very difficult for President Trump to make good on his interest or intentions to improve relations. I know that there are a number of Russian advisors and experts that the administration employs that are very good, very qualified, and they're pushing certain areas of cooperation. So I hope and I'm optimistic that on the crucial matters, nuclear-related issues, what we would call strategic stability, potentially cyber-related discussions will occur. at a working level. And I'm hoping also that the nuclear-related treaties, the INF and others, will be something that we can talk constructively about. And counterterrorism, of course, so between the special services and the Russian government. So I think it would be a mistake to think of the relationship as not going anywhere over the next 2 years, but it certainly will be difficult for the president to make a dramatic improvement in U.S.-Russian relations.
So the Democrats were certain, or were hoping at least, for a blue wave to come and crush the Republican control over Congress. And yet, despite all the rigorous Trump bashing from mainstream outlets and celebrities, they didn't get the desired outcome, as they did get the House, but the GOP enhanced its control over the Senate and still leads the way in terms of the number of governor posts. So in your view, was the blue wave more like a blue ripple? How were the Republicans able to get such results despite the perceived anti-Trump dominance in terms of outreach and mass media?
I don't think there was a blue wave. I think Democrats are rightly pleased that they retook the House and did it fairly decisively. By the same token, I think Republicans and President Trump are happy that they added to their strength in the Senate. So I think what the election showed me, again, as a citizen and not a particular expert, is that the country's polarized. And we're polarized very clearly down what I would call urban-rural lines. Urban America votes Democratic to an extreme, and rural America is solidly Republican country. So we're a very divided country, and I think we have to find a way to appeal for the messages, whether it's a Republican or a Democratic message, to appeal to citizens of all kinds in all parts of the country. And that's going to be the challenge going forward.
There are calls among the Democrats to put more congressional control over the use of force in places like Iraq and Syria, to be able to limit or decide when to end deployment. With the House gone blue, how likely is that to be on the cards? Can Congress muster enough strength to influence this?
Potentially, the Congress can. I mean, certainly the Democratic Congress is going to have to decide what its main priorities are. They're not going to get everything they want. They're not going to force the president to capitulate or the Republicans to give up on their interests. So it's every president, every party has to have a top three list, I call it, particularly with only 2 years till the 2020 election. And the Democrats are going to have to choose their battles wisely. And I don't know whether that's going to be at the top of their list, frankly. Now, the real wild card is we have, in the last 2 years, been relatively quiet as far as terrorism and wars. The U.S. is largely pulled out of Iraq and Afghanistan. So the issue of how we use force and where we use it hasn't been as intense as it was in previous years. But that could all change in a single day, in a single incident, if we wake up one morning and something's happened somewhere in the world that requires a strong U.S. response.
The current authorization of force that Washington is using dates back to 2001, post 9/11. What's wrong with this one anyways?
Right.
I mean, it's been working fine for all these years, no?
I'm of the school of thought that we need to continually modify our law, our rules, and how we engage and why we engage, and I think that's outdated. For one thing, the context for developing that the rules of use of force were, of course, post 9/11, and the world's a very different place. I, for example, am not as enamored. I'm not such a fan of drone strikes and what we would call covert action, use of intelligence and military to conduct kinetic actions. Now, it doesn't mean we shouldn't. I'm just saying I think we've over-relied on those things as opposed to, say, classic policy, foreign policy, rule of law, international rule of law, and including, and it's funny as an intelligence officer that I would emphasize that, but I would just stress that I did what I did in my career to enhance the power of what I call legitimate statecraft, which would be diplomacy, which would be negotiation, which would be peaceful resolution of conflict. I'm not a fan when it skews too heavy in the use of military force involving any country, whether that be the U.S. or Russia.
So the Democrats are also widely expected to relaunch House investigations into Trump's alleged dealings with Russia. Trump, in the meantime, recently swapped Jeff Sessions to Matt Whitaker, a man seen by the Democrats as a partisan Trump loyalist, as the acting attorney general. Some are saying this is actually Trump bracing for a fight against a Russia investigation. Can that be the case? And how much of a shield would Whitaker be when it comes to House investigations?
Well, my personal view is there's no question the president put someone in to replace Jeff Sessions who he feels will protect him. At least that's my interpretation as a citizen. I think that's his leading qualification. He's kind of somebody who came from nowhere, who now has this highest position in the land as far as ensuring our perpetuation of our rule of law. And so I'm very concerned about his motives or his previous statements he's made about the Mueller investigation. But I'm confident, in spite of that, that the Mueller investigation, I know Bob Mueller personally. I knew him as the FBI director. I believe he has the highest integrity of almost any official I know. I think he's going to produce soon the final judgments of a very long investigation, and the country's going to have to take a look at those, and every citizen is going to have to decide what he or she thinks of Mueller's conclusions. That's assuming, of course, that the Justice Department will release all of them to the public, and I'm making that assumption when I say that.
Will the Democrats in the House now pursue this investigation a lot more aggressively? Will it get back into the headlines again? And can they use it to seriously damage the president and maybe even start talk of impeachment again?
I personally believe that it would be a mistake to impeach the president based on what we know today as we're sitting here doing this interview, Sophie, because I haven't heard anything yet that puts the president in the middle of a conspiracy to work with the Russian government or obstructs justice to the point where I would say the only solution is impeachment. And that's understanding that if the Democrats move to impeach the president, in all likelihood, the Senate, which is controlled by the Republicans, won't convict them. So do we really want to go down the same road we went with President Clinton over the Monica Lewinsky affair? So that's a big question. The second question really is, though, let's wait and see what the investigation produces. We don't know what the final, say, indictments are going to be, who will be indicted for what potential crimes. And I think that will give us a clearer idea of what we need to do as a country. I'm just hoping that the Democrats, and I say this not being certain, will do the right thing by the country and not do the right thing by the party. I would say the same thing to the Republicans. This is a much too serious matter than to allow partisan politics to drive a process of seeking justice. If we're talking about justice, and I think that's what we're talking about, we need to hold it to the Richard Nixon standard of the Watergate hearings, which resulted in the resignation of the president in 1974. If it reaches that level, okay, then we need to take a look at what we need to do. But if it doesn't, let's not try to raise it artificially to a level that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. You know, look at Trump, and he has been running the country in this campaign mode ever since he won the presidency. I mean, his rallies never stop. His language is very campaign. Is he already aiming at the next presidential poll? I mean, is the whole American electoral cycle more or less turning into this permanent campaign anyway with, you know, major votes every 2 years?
I honestly don't know what motivates the president. I don't understand him. I don't support, certainly on his foreign policies where I'm most expert, I have a hard time understanding what he's trying to achieve. I think he's been destructive as far as American interests. I might add, by the way, that I don't think he's been helpful for Russian interests. I believe, and I can't speak, of course, for President Putin or the Russian people, but I like my U.S. presidents to be predictable. I like my U.S. presidents to stand on a basis of existing agreements and things like that. So I don't honestly understand the what motivates the action, whether it's on trade or on foreign policy, national security policy. And if I did understand it, I could give you a better answer. And I don't know whether he's motivated by the next election or simply trying to do what he thinks he needs to do in these 4 years. So it's a very difficult question for me to answer since I don't see a rationale to the pattern of his behavior.
What are your expectations for the potential meeting between Trump and Putin later this November at the G20 summit in Argentina? How much importance does the personal rapport between the two leaders play in the relations between U.S. and Russia?
Well, so far, the so-called personal rapport has been, a disaster, I think, for both sides. The Helsinki summit was horrible. I think the president's reactions to President Trump's reactions to President Putin's statements were completely, I could not understand why he didn't respond more forcefully to the Russian president. I don't understand what President Putin's thinking was, that he thinks he could, unless his intention was to reach out to the American people with a very strong, dark message, which is what he managed to do. I don't see how the rapport or their personal relationship is doing anything to improve relations between our two countries. And if anything, up to this point, it's made things worse.
So I wonder, is this Russian attitude purely partisan? If the Republican president was a real enemy of Russia, would the Democrats be hard on him for being confrontational instead?
I think we have a long history of examining, what drives effective U.S.-Russian relations. I think it's when both countries feel secure and confident, and we have leaders on both sides who are expressing the will, the general will of their people. And so, for example, on the U.S. side, I think it's, even though, of course, President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev was a very controversial period in Russian history, nonetheless, I think most Russians I knew at that time and to this day respected President Reagan, and it didn't, of course, think of him as a hardliner. I remember he called Russia an evil empire until about halfway through his 8-year term when he pivoted and he realized that the opportunity to strike historic deals with U.S. and Russia was too great to set aside because of our Cold War history. I think that's what we need now. We need leaders who are strong, meaning if I were advising President Trump, I would stress, don't fawn over President Putin. Don't call him your great ally. Don't agree with him on things that are not in U.S. interest. Fight back in areas where U.S. interests diverge from Russian interests. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with saying we disagree strongly on certain issues, but we respect one another and we're going to work out our differences.
All right. Well, thank you very much for this interview. It's been a pleasure talking to you, as usual. We were talking to two-decade CIA veteran Rolf Mowat Larsen discussing the growing rift between U.S. and the rest of the world. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
Thank you, Sophie.
Thank you, Rolf.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.